Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest adventure, the latest in a list of unmistakable and unmissable happenings on life on Planet Porky, with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. And Miss Jones, there's only one place to start now, and probably will be for the next couple of weeks on Planet Porky, and that is getting our telescope up and focusing from Planet Porky on Qatar, where the World Cup is taking place, because we are only a day after England's fantastic 6-2 victory to open the tournament, and your fellow countrymen a few hours later grabbing a late equaliser against USA. It's all going so well so far.
Except for the fact that we shouldn't be there.
Well, I'm afraid that's a different argument now. I had all that debate. In fact, I was drafted onto GMB, Good Morning Britain, to talk about the state of mind of the footballers, and, you know, including the Iranian footballers that England played, who, by the way, turned out to be very brave young men because they refused to sing their own national anthem in protest.
I saw that. I have to say I have huge admiration for them for that, but I hope they don't get beheaded when they go home.
I doubt if they'll go home now. What they will probably do is they will probably, you know, they've got the world's admiration for standing up to the nasty, brutal Iranian regime, and I would imagine now they will seek political asylum somewhere like America or something like that. They're good footballers. They can earn their living. You see what I mean? And certainly that's what I would do. I wouldn't go back to Iran now if I'd taken part in that protest.
It's tough to leave your families and
it is.
And your childhood behind, isn't it?
It is, but you know, people are experiencing this sort of thing. They could well have got their families out by now, you see what I mean? Because certainly you're absolutely right. If you suddenly upset Iran and don't go back to Iran, they do pick on your family. I totally agree, and it could be nasty. So I just hope it all works out for them. It's such a rotten, horrible world sometimes, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, it is. And I always think something like the World Cup highlights that as well. Yeah. It highlights the differences and the injustices and the inequalities.
It does. But anyway, getting down to the football, because I did feel a great sigh of relief when, you know, a couple of days ago when England kicked off, and I thought, now for the next 90 minutes, it's like being on an island. You don't have to worry about all the politics that have surrounded it, you know. And of course, it was a sparkling performance by England, 6-2, and 3-0 up at half time. Three young strikers all scored fantastic goals. So that was all terrific. And Gareth Southgate, you know, vindicated in, because England have had a terrible run of six games in which they only scored one goal. So that was that. But the highlight for me, Miss Jones, as we're on Planet Porky and you're here with me, has been the celebration of your outstandingly famous uncle, Cliff Jones. Cliff Jones, for the benefit of our millions of listeners, was actually a member of the Spurs double-winning team of 61-62. He was the flying winger. He played with Jimmy Greaves and Dave Mackay and Danny Blanchflower. And he is still with us in his 80s and has, you know, been very public over the last week, because I think he's the only surviving Welsh player who played in the World Cup in 1958 and is still with us today. That's a pretty fantastic record, isn't it?
Bless his heart. He's been doing so much in the papers, on television, radio. And you're quite right. Yes, he was in the Welsh side of 1958, the World Cup that was in Sweden.
That's right.
Which very few people remember, I think.
Yeah.
And he even played against a 17-year-old Pelé. Nobody knew who he
Incredible.
Was at that point, or what kind of career he was going to go
Pelé
on.
Pelé scored his first international goal in that game.
Yeah.
At 17.
But Uncle Cliff, he was the Gareth Bale of his day.
Yeah.
And the most expensive player at Spurs. Yeah. The transfer fee, by the way, was £35,000.
£35,000.
Oft quoted in my family.
Yeah.
But I thought it was very funny what he said about Gareth Bale, actually. He said, I love the way the Welsh say the name. My brother is called Gareth, and they pronounce it Gareth. And he said, Gareth. He said, he's got my pace, but I'm not sure about the looks. Which is a classic Cliff remark.
Sure. He looks very good for his age now. You described him as looking like a Thunderbirds puppet, and I wasn't sure whether you're being complimentary or not.
No, of course I was being complimentary. He's what I was trying to say was that he's got that sort of timeless. He's never changed. Yeah. He is exactly today as I remember him when I was a very small child.
Yeah, golly, amazing.
And Thunderbird puppets never age, do
no,
they?
Of course they don't. No, of course.
If they come on the telly now, they look the same as when we were kids.
And they're always very polished. And
yes.
£35,000 for the transfer fee. I think Gareth Bale's salary at Real Madrid is something like $650,000 a week. Just put that into perspective, eh?
Which makes you think, doesn't it? Yeah,
it does.
Cliff was on about 20 quid a week when my dad was also a player, of course, and I think my dad was being paid about 3 quid a week when we were kids.
It was something like that. I mean, my father told me that in the post-war years, it was £4 for if you lost, £5 if you drew, £6 if you won. And that was people like Dixie Dean, the greatest ever England scorer, you know, and things like that. But anyway, there we go. Now,
and these guys ran families on that amount.
They did.
Which, pause for thought.
They did. Now, also, Miss Jones, you've been doing a blog, I think, on the World Cup. What did your blog tell us?
I expressed my disgust that we're even there in the first place. I do feel very strongly that we should have boycotted this World Cup.
Yeah.
And that we're made of better stuff. We're supposed to be made of grit and courage. Mm. We are Brits. We are Englishmen and Welshmen. We should have taken a stand and we shouldn't have gone. And for that reason, I am not watching any single game in this World Cup. And I'm somebody who grew up on the World Cup.
Yeah.
My father covered 10 World Cup tournaments. I've got his official badges from the 1966 tournament.
Yeah.
It's very dear to my heart. So it's painful to me to not take part, to not watch it. But I'm taking a stand.
Well, that's a very commendable position to be in. I can't. I mean, look, I feel a lot like you do about a lot of the issues. What are we doing there? It was obviously bought. That's without doubt. Why else would Qatar get it unless there'd been inducements to take it there? It was the same with Russia 4 years earlier. You know, massive corruption surrounds FIFA. I think half of the 21 executive committee who made the decisions have since been investigated or prosecuted in some way relating to, you know, errant money deals and all that kind of stuff. So we all know that. But at the end of the day, I thought it's the World Cup and England have to be there. And, you know, the old Qatari government who were trying to tell us all, don't worry, we'll all be very liberal by the time we get there, are making last-minute decisions showing how illiberal they are, like banning alcohol from the grounds, which they said they wouldn't, and, of course, the armband, you know, the rainbow armband that both the Welsh and the English wanted to wear, banned at the last minute, and there's nothing you can do about it. But anyway, there we go.
But, you know, I think that things like wearing armbands, taking the knee, these are hollow gestures, aren't they, really? They don't make any difference.
Well, I tend to agree a bit, yeah. No, I know what you mean, but you're saying we shouldn't have gone. Well, if they'd have pulled out at the last minute and said, no, we wear the armbands or we don't go on the pitch, that would have been so cataclysmic. And you've got to remember also, money talks. You might not like that, but it does. And, you know, the England team are sponsored for tens of millions of pounds by, you know, big business, by shirt manufacturers, boot manufacturers, all that kind of stuff. So I'm afraid it's all tied up in that.
They have obligations. I'm not stupid enough to think otherwise.
Yeah.
But I take this way, way back. They had 12 years to sort this out.
Oh, exactly. They should have sorted it out 12 years ago, and they didn't. My most interesting character that I've been reading about in the build-up to the World Cup is Sven Hran Eriksson, OK?
Now, the shagger.
Mega shagger, yeah. Now, Sven, of course, was the England team manager after Kevin Keegan walked out. I don't know if you remember, but Kevin Keegan was in charge of England playing Germany in the last ever game at Wembley. And we lost 1-0. I think it's Dietmar Hamann scored a late free kick or something. And because of the defeat, Keegan went back to the dressing room and then immediately quit as England manager without any notice. My friend Claire Tomlinson, who's a reporter and sportscaster on Sky, went into the dressing room to interview Keegan, just do the post-match interview, you know what I mean? And he suddenly, and they were in the showers area, and he suddenly announced he was quitting. And that was the first anybody in the world knew about it. So, and I was there at the time. I was talking, believe it or not, to the great German captain in the banqueting suite when I suddenly heard Keegan had resigned. And I've forgotten his name now.
I can't remember. Yeah, I don't know.
I'll remember it in a minute. And
going back to Sven, I think it was at that stage when he was appointed that I thought, this has all gone wrong somehow. How can we have a Swede managing the England team, our national side? That doesn't add up for me.
No, I felt exactly the same. He was very kind of English in the way he went about things, if you see what I mean.
It's not the point. No, he's a Swede.
I agree. I tell you, I've never... And it got even worse when we appointed Capello, the Italian...
Oh, Fabio.
Fabio Capello, Italian. I mean, he's even worse. He couldn't even speak English properly. I mean, literally.
which says it all, doesn't it, really? Or not, as the case may be.
We went to one introductory lunch with him, you know, and he had to have the correspondent from Italian Gazzetta, you know, the Italian sports newspaper, sitting next to him as interpreter. He couldn't speak English. I mean, how does a manager say to his players in a split second during the heat of a game and issue an instruction if he doesn't speak proper English? And, of course, none of the players speak Italian. I mean, it was mad. But getting back to Sven was a mega shagger. I mean, apparently from day one, you know, Sven was prowling the corridors of the Football Association headquarters in, I think it was in Soho Square then, you know, looking at all the available sort of potential conquests he could make with the women there. And he did make a lot. And it caused a lot of scandals. And at one time, the chief executive actually quit because it was discovered that Sven and a chief executive were seeing the same lady. I mean, it was unbelievable, honestly. And
I never saw what any of these women saw in him. Well, had he not been the England manager, I mean, just take the elements of that individual, that person. Yeah. There's nothing really to kind of drop your jaws for, is there?
Well, Miss Jones, this is a family show, and I don't think expressions like drop your jaws, you know, is necessarily...
Well, how is that more offensive than mega shagger?
Well, yes, okay, I take your point. But you've got to remember, when he arrived with a gorgeous Italian lady, Nancy Dell'Olio, on his arm, you know, with long, fulsome black hair and pouting lips and all that, and everybody was stunned. You know, she was like a Miss World. And allegedly a lawyer. She's always described herself as a lawyer, but nobody's actually seen her practice law. But
Well, I think she was a corporate lawyer. So, you know, the kind of lawyer who goes through the motions of all the training and so on. There are a lot of lawyers out there like this. And then they go to a big company, a big corporate setup, and become the in-house, like Tom Crone, if you remember, at News
Tom,
World,
well.
At News International, I should say. He was the in-house lawyer there, wasn't
he? Yes, he was. Yes.
So they're not all lawyers who practice in the courtroom.
Right, okay. Well, good for her. I'm not knocking it anyway. You know, she was qualified lawyer, no doubt about it. And Sven went up to her husband after he'd met them as a couple and told her husband he was going to make a hit on Nancy, and he hoped he didn't mind. I think at the time he was manager of a club in Rome. I think it was, not sure if it was Roma or the one that Gazza played for. But anyway, he...
What was that, Lazio?
Lazio, well done. Thank you very much, Miss Jones. But he was, you know, he was clearly very confident with women. And after he stepped down, of course, it was revealed that he and Ulrika Johnson, a fellow Swede, had allegedly had a dalliance as well.
What, did you see pictures of her this week in the press?
Which ones? Because I see her picture all the time.
I can't remember where I saw them.
Column, doesn't she? Yeah.
Yeah, but no, not it wasn't her column pictures, but there were some other sort of candid shots.
Oh, yeah.
And I couldn't believe how much she's aged.
Well, look, it's not really a very nice thing to say about a lady, is it? Because we all age.
It's an observation. It's not a criticism.
Yeah. No, I suppose you're right. I see her column quite a lot, but I've given up reading it because I, you know, I, look, it's horrible to be critical about another fellow journalist, but
you're calling Ulrika Johnson a journalist now?
Well, she is if she's got a column in a national newspaper. You have to say, you know, well, that's somebody's employed her to do it.
Oh, I'd probably dispute that because if you think of all the years we spent on the road and training and learning the job, you know, putting a few items together for a column is not a journalist.
Yeah. No.
I would have to argue that.
Yeah, you could be right. I remember doing World Cups in the past, you know, and a couple of ex-footballers would sort of suddenly put on a vest which said press, you know what I mean, and then go around describing themselves as journaliste, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So I know exactly what you mean. Miss Jones, have you had an egg? Or eggs, boiled eggs, fried eggs for your breakfast this morning?
No, I haven't. Although I do eat eggs. I do tend to have eggs because I'm not very good at forward planning meals because I'm in different places all the time.
Right.
So I quite often find myself at home with not very much food in the fridge.
Yes.
But there'll always be a little box of eggs. And so I'll make scrambled eggs or an omelette, chuck any vegetables in that might be in the drawer. But yeah, eggs it's just one of those fallback things. They're not very exciting, but they're good for you.
So why is there a national crisis now because we've got an egg shortage? I don't understand it. People panicking. I saw somebody in the supermarket yesterday holding 6 boxes of eggs. And I mean big boxes, you know, like 12 eggs in each one. I've never eaten an egg in my life.
I can't believe you haven't eaten an egg.
Never eaten an egg in my life.
What, your mum never gave you a boiled egg when you were little?
Well, she tried to, but I could never eat it.
So what is it? Does it turn your stomach?
Yes, it does. It makes me gag. And I remember absolutely specifically, it's the white, rubbery, you know, what's it? Context, not context. The constitution.
The texture of it.
The texture of the outside of an egg, the white bit, right, taste to me like rubber in my mouth. And I just, that's the only thing I can remember. And my mum tried to get me to eat an egg. She tried to dip toast in an egg. She tried to give me an egg sandwich. And this is all before the age of about 2. She could never get me to eat an egg. And I've never eaten an egg since. And I do regret it because when I see a plate of bacon and eggs, you know, if I'm in a hotel somewhere and somebody's, you know, served themselves some bacon and a fried egg, and then they, you know, put their knife into it and all the yellow spills out, I think it looks absolutely lovely. And I don't find the smell off-putting or anything like that. I just can't put it in my mouth. And I regret it because it must have been nice to have been able to eat eggs all those years.
You obviously need egg therapy, don't you?
I need some sort of therapy like that. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
I know what you mean, though. When I lived in Los Angeles years ago, there was a craze for egg white omelettes.
Oh, okay.
So they'd chuck away the yolk
because
they had some issue. I don't know. It's a kind of very high dose of protein, isn't it? The yolk. But I never saw the point of eating only the whites. But you'd see these omelettes rock up, these tiny little omelettes with bits of parsley on the top.
Yes.
And they were just pure white. And they looked like some horrible thing had just been born.
Well, that's the thing James Corden fell foul of, wasn't it, in this recent...
That's right, yes,
New
because
York.
There was... Yes, yeah. There were streaks of egg yolk in his wife's egg white omelette.
You can't believe it, can you? No, Miss Jones.
Get a life is my answer to that.
Yeah, that's right, you get a life. He's come back, isn't he, James Corden? So,
I don't think he should hurry.
Well, that's a bit harsh, isn't it? I've always quite liked him. I met him a couple of times, I think I've said before, doing these football things, you know, like spoof interviews with David Beckham. Excuse me, and that kind of thing. Always quite got on with them. But anyway, look, who was it who said the rich are different to us? And I think the famous are different to us as well.
They have more money.
Yeah, that's right. I saw a picture of your great pal, Noddy Holder, right? In a double-page spread in a newspaper. And he's promoting Iceland, not the country, Iceland, the frozen food merchants. But I couldn't quite understand. There were no words on the page. There was just Noddy's face, and you just said that you thought Ulrika Johnson started to look old. I think Noddy looks terribly old because we all remember Noddy Holder standing on that stage with his top hat on, with all mirrors stitched on it, singing Goodbye to Jane and all that. And I was quite shocked.
Can we just acknowledge that the 1970s is an awful long time ago?
Well, yeah, sure.
And Noddy's 76 now. And I suppose it's how we define old. Mm. What would you say was the cutoff for middle age, and at that point we become old? What age would you
I would say these days about 75.
Okay, so he's old then.
Right, so he's just 1 year into being old, I suppose.
Yeah. But my mum is 87 and she's very sprightly. Yes. She's tiny. I think little people age much better than great big people, yeah. Somehow. Well, I don't know why.
My mum was tiny as well. She became a little old lady with white hair, you know. You know, loved her to bits, obviously, but that's how it is. Talking about your mother and my mother, by the way. Well, you mentioned last week sort of briefly about, you know, hospitals not being available to people at weekends, and how I went to the Bournemouth Hospital on Sunday and I couldn't find anybody in there. It was deserted. But it's a bigger scandal than I thought. I saw a follow-up story to that this week in which some major hospital, and there was a picture of the car park, and there's always a row about, you know, car parks in hospitals because the nurses and the workers have to pay for them and all that. This car park was deserted at 2 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, indicating there's nobody there. And you know, the more I read about the state of the health service in this country, the more I get worried that we are wasting billions and billions of pounds.
I've been saying for years, and the only reason I've been saying it for years, yeah, is that my ex-husband's cousin is a consultant dermatologist, right, a professor. He's worked in the health service all his life, as well as private practice. Mm. And he's been saying for a long, long time that the health service is on a collision course and that it won't exist in 20 years'
yeah,
time.
I think so.
And the reason is that it's not fit for purpose. It wasn't built for a population that has exploded beyond reckoning. Mm. There are more people alive. I love this fact. There are more people alive today than have ever lived.
Yes.
On this planet.
Yes.
And how was a health service in a very small country like ours,
yeah,
how is it ever going to sustain?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And it will fall to bits because of the finances. You can't just keep throwing money at it. I wish somebody would have a look at it, root and branch, excuse me, and try and get value for money, because it's just a colossal, you know, behemoth. Nobody can control it and waste money. But we shouldn't be moaning about those sort of things. Miss Jones, what do you think about the return of the perm haircut for men?
No, absolutely not. I really hope not. Did you ever have a perm in your life?
No, I didn't, no. I've only ever had one haircut, and that was, you know, from the age of about 16, I used to have a part down the middle of my head and let my hair grow out either side, almost like a sort of Bee Gees type haircut, you know what I mean? But that has never changed until the last sort of 5 or 6 years when my hair started disappearing, so I've had to sort of try and fluff it up a bit, you know what I mean?
Well, at least you don't do a comb over, which I always think just looks just pathetic. So pathetic on men, doesn't it?
But
no, perms, God, I had a perm once. Mm. And I think my hair is still recovering. If we were meant to have curly hair, we'd have it, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Kevin Keegan, of course, was the most famous male perm haircut that we ever had. But that was in the 70s, and all footballers had perms in those days.
Didn't Glenn Hoddle have a perm
as well? I don't think he did. I had him in my head as well.
He just looked like that.
Well, maybe. I had him in my head because Glenn's been on the telly this week because of the start of the World Cup, obviously, and he hasn't got anything like a perm now. But no, he remember he made a song with the other Chris Waddle.
Oh, Hoddle and Waddle or something.
That's right, yeah, Chris Waddle and Glenn Hoddle. Diamond Lights, I think it was called. And, you know, it was awful, but it was, you know, very popular for footballers to do those sort of things in those days.
There was a big trend back then for sportsmen to make records.
Yes.
And the England team always had a record. Do you remember the 1971 back home?
Watching,
yeah.
Watching and waiting while we are far away.
Oh, he knows the word. And you'd see them on Top of the Pops, the whole team,
right,
sort of all lined up there, all giving it all that.
Yeah.
And Tony Jacklin made an album. Do you remember the golfer?
No.
I still have it because I inherited my dad's record collection and I still have that album and it's called Tony Jacklin Swings.
Good God, Tony Jacklin Swings, like a golf swing. He was very famous, Tony Jacklin. He won the Open in this country and the US Open in the same year as a young golfer aged about 24 or something. He was the first great British golfing star.
But I never understood this requirement to make pop stars out of them. You know, it was a funny thing, wasn't it? But do you remember the 66 song? That had a revival. Sort of each time a World Cup came along in the in the 70s and 80s. World Cup Willie.
He's dressed in red, white and blue. World Cup Willie. We all love him too. World Cup Willie. He's tough as a lion and never will give up. And that's why Willie is the favourite for the cup.
Oh, very good. He even knows the lyrics this time. That's fantastic.
Absolutely brilliant. Old Glenn, by the way, I've got to know Glenn quite well, working in radio, and he's a big mate of Alan Brazil's because they played together at Spurs. So we used to see quite a lot of Glenn. We used to go to this place, I can't remember what it's called. It's called the Complete Angler. And it's
oh, I know it. Yes, it's down at Henley.
That's right. Well done. Yeah,
that sort of way. Yeah, I've stayed there actually. It's a very nice
place. It's beautiful. And we used to see Glenn there because the England training camp was quite nearby, and we used to go and do radio shows there. You know what I mean? And then see Glenn afterwards. But great guy. I've always really enjoyed his company talking about football. And of course, he literally did come back from the dead. He died, and his heart stopped in a radio studio. And but for a technician who was trained in sort of, you know, first aid, who was on the floor, Glenn wouldn't be with us now. But, you know, we're so glad he is. Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Myself, the Portmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Now, Miss Jones, I don't wish to, you know, intrude on the privacy of your life, but if you ever found yourself short of company one way or another, would you go and buy a 5'7" teddy bear called Loving Bear Puffy? And could you ever imagine that being a substitute for a real live human being companion?
Oh, don't be ridiculous. I mean, this is a horrible idea, isn't it? It's akin to having a blow-up doll.
It's sort of like a bit like that, I mean, except it's a solid teddy bear. I mean, I saw a newspaper piece on it, and it's as tall as a human being. And, you know, they did all the set pics. You're sitting there watching the telly, and the teddy bear's in the chair next to you watching the telly. I mean, how can anybody... I mean, you know, like sometimes animals that have become orphans early on, like, you know, a little, I don't know, a little whatever, monkey or something like that. They might put a knitted wool monkey into the pen, and the monkey will adopt it and all that kind of stuff. But we're supposed to have a great deal more intelligence than animals.
And we're also talking fully grown adults, you know. Look, little children, I've brought up three kids. They do have their little coyote or their little stuffed rabbit or a teddy bear here and there that they like to go to bed and hug. Yeah. But you grow out of those things. I think I've got them all upstairs in my house, all the ones that they slept with all those years. Yeah. But they grow up and out of those things. And I think to reintroduce a token from childhood like that is probably quite dangerous in a way. Yeah. I must admit, when I was pregnant, each of my pregnancies, because you get very uncomfortable towards the end and you need something to rest the bump on, as it were. Yeah. So you'd sometimes hug a pillow and sort of support the bump in that way. Yes. But look, there's no substitute for the real thing, is there? No. But I think also we become accustomed to sleeping on our own again.
Mm, yeah, no.
And I think I would find it very hard to share my sleeping space with somebody else now.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. But I don't think it's just like a sleeping companion. It's supposed to sort of, you know, give you comfort during the day when it's sitting there. And it reminded me chillingly of Dennis Nilsson, who was the guy who...
Oh, the mass murderer.
Mass murderer, yeah, who went around sort of, you know, befriending young homeless men, taking them home and then killing them and then keeping their head in the fridge and all this kind of stuff. And so,
oh, do you want to know even worse? I knew a couple really well for quite a long time who lived in the house next door to his.
Yeah, well, I think I've told you before, one of the reporters, Alex Hendry, on the Daily Express, lived in the same street. And of course, for years afterwards, he got mocked that the mass killer, you know, the biggest story that could ever have broken in his life, lived about, I think, about 10 doors away or something like that.
Oh, it was right on his doorstep and he missed it.
It was something Gardens, wasn't it, the name of the street?
Yes, it was. It was up in sort of North London somewhere.
Yes, I mean, Gardens. But the reason I mention that is because the journalist who eventually wrote the definitive book on the story called it killing for company. And that's because Dennis Nilsson used to kill these poor, unfortunate men, but then leave them sitting in a chair for up to a week and would come home from work and make a cup of tea, switch the telly on, and then talk to them as if they were alive, you know?
Oh, yeah. What a madman.
Ghastly, yeah, ghastly. We shouldn't be talking about that on a family show.
No, we really shouldn't. But can I just ask, what happened to Dennis Nilsson?
He died in jail. He got a full life sentence. Well, he got life with 30 years, I think, but then it was turned into a full life sentence. And then, as I recall, he just died of something in jail, a heart attack or something, you know what I mean, due to old age. But there you go. Now, Miss Jones, I want to pay tribute to Princess Anne, okay? Because there's been a lot of talk recently about, you know, the weight of responsibility and the workload that our new king, King Charles, has to endure, and he needs other royals to help him. And Andrew and Harry, of course, have been sort of banished. Harry chose to be a non-working royal. Andrew's been literally sort of blackballed out of the family because of the shocking scandal surrounding him relating to Jeffrey Epstein and young women who've been sexually abused. And so the thinking is now that the one who should step up and be alongside him all the time is Princess Anne. And I have to say, I totally agree with that. And even more so when I read just a small paragraph recently that last weekend she flew to the Falkland Islands, 8,000 miles away, to take part in a ceremony for a few hours, right, and then flew back again on a military aircraft. And they're not very comfortable, these military aircraft. It's just like a seat, you know, in the sort of hold and that kind of stuff. So I have to say, I do admire her for her work ethic.
I couldn't agree more. We've said this before, haven't we? She is the best queen we never had.
Yes.
She's the hardest working royal, bar Her Majesty herself, the least self-serving. Her motto is never complain, never explain, or the other way round. Yeah. And she just rolls up her sleeves and gets on with it. I think she's admirable. And yes, I think Charles is very lucky to have her as his lieutenant by his side.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. Did we talk about gaslights last time we did a podcast, Miss Jones? I wanted to talk about gaslights, and I think afterwards I didn't think I had. Have I talked to you about gaslights?
I can't recall having had that conversation.
No, and I'm not talking about gaslighting now, an expression which I still don't understand when somebody is gaslighted, you know. It's like a form of sort of mental bullying, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it sort of means it's one of those trendy new terms, isn't it? But if somebody who you've been very close to just cuts you out of their life just like that.
Yes, that's right.
Just sort of pretends you don't exist, I think that's
But I think it's also when people sort of give you backhanded compliments all the time, you know what I mean? It chips away at your confidence and that kind of stuff. You know, people put you down and all that. Anyway, look, I didn't want to talk about gaslighting in itself. I want to talk about gas lamps, okay? Because is it Rhys Jones? What's the name of the guy who Griff Rhys Jones? Is it? That's it, isn't it? Is he the actor?
Yeah, yeah, the one who used to have a duo going with Mel Smith.
Absolutely, that's right. Poor old Mel Smith, who died, of course. Yeah,
R.I.P. Yeah.
Did you know Mel Smith, by the way?
I had a memorable evening with the two of them once at the Roof Gardens on top of the old Derry and Toms building. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
And Richard Branson launched it as a nightclub. Yeah. And it was a famous spot during the 80s.
Yes.
It had roof gardens open to the air with lakes and flamingos and fish and palm trees and all that.
Yeah.
And you'd go up there for a party and get drunk. And there was a little shed, I suppose it was a little summer house type thing, in one corner over right at the edge of this roof garden.
Right.
And I remember stealing in there with Mel and Griff. I had just done a video with them.
Right.
They had a film called Morons from Outer Space.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. It was shocking. It was absolutely...
Yeah, it was so bad, it was quite good.
That's right,
And they shot a video for the single called Morons from Outer Space.
Right.
And I was in that video, and they shot it at the Hippodrome, another nightclub in London.
Owned by Big Stringfellow.
Peter Stringfellow, that's right. And we just bumped into each other at this party. I think it was a Queen party after one of their shows at Wembley or something. And off we nipped. We stole this champagne off the sort of drinks table. Yeah. And off we went and sort of spent the night in this little shed, just chewing the card, and the sun came up, and there we still were.
Wow, that's fantastic. I used to see Mel Smith at the races. He was a big gambler, and sometimes you'd get in your box and you'd go out on the balcony and you'd look to your right and double take, and it was Mel Smith, you know. He was a very funny man. He introduced Queen, didn't he, at the Live Aid concert?
Yes, I think they do it together.
They had police uniforms on. And
I was going to say, they were dressed as policemen.
That's right, yeah. And now, ladies and gentlemen, pray mercy for the Queen. Oh, no, it's not her, it's them. And all that kind of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, of course, nobody in any other part of the world would have got that or known who Mel Griff would have known even who they were.
Yeah, but anyway, point of the story is that you know, sometimes these people are very famous, go off on a tangent, don't they? You know, like Brian May goes off on tangents all over the place, you know, astrophysicist and badgers and all that kind of stuff. And Griff Rhys-Jones wants to save the few remaining gas lamps in Victorian London. And there's some around the House of Commons. There are some in an alleyway, I think, in Islington, North London, and there's a few in West London. And he wants to save them because he thinks they're part of our national treasure. Now, that might seem a bit odd because somebody's got to light a gas lamp, if you see what I mean. But you won't believe this. The reason why I was so fascinated about his interest in gas lamps is that when I was brought up in a little cul-de-sac street in Chester called Laurel Grove, there was a gas lamp at the end of the road, at the entrance to the entry, which took you into the street next door. And it was a gas lamp. And every evening in the winter at about 5 o'clock, this little fella used to come along on his bike, and strapped to his crossbar was a ladder. And it was a ladder that pointed to a triangle at the top. Do you see what I mean? I remember it so distinctly. So he'd get off his bike, put his bike up against the wall, take the ladder off his crossbar, put the ladder up against the gas lamp. He would go up, open the front glass panel and light the lamp. How about that?
What with?
Well, I don't know, a match, I suppose, or some kind of...
Well, how dangerous. I mean, they used to explode all the time, those gas lamps, didn't they?
Ours didn't explode in our street, honestly. But I look back now and I think, my God, either I'm very, very old or that must have been one of the last remaining, you know, gas lamps in the world. I suppose Northern England, you know, took a bit longer to catch up into the modern world post-war than Southern England. But I can barely believe that that happened in my lifetime.
Didn't they call them Learys, the guys who lit them?
Oh, they might have done. I mean, they might have done. You know, it was a very unusual job, wasn't it? And a very unusual task, you know what I mean?
I think they were called Learys, and I think that came up in the Mary Poppins
film. Oh, did it?
Film, yeah. The Mary Poppins Returns.
That means, right.
The, I seem to remember. I could be wrong, but I think they were Learys, But I think they're very dangerous things, and I think, look, I mean, we're all trying to burn less gas now. What is the point of trying to preserve gas street lighting?
Well, I think it's quaint. I don't want the world to become modern too fast and too quickly. I love seeing steam trains, right? I'll sometimes, if I know there's a steam train coming through somewhere down here in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, I'll drive over excuse me, to a little hardly used station, which has been kept beautifully, you know, by the station master with bowls of flowers all over the place, and it's painted up nicely and tidied up. And you see a steam engine roaring through. I loved steam engines when I was a kid. Do you remember them? You're probably not old enough.
Well, I mean, obviously they've been in so many films, haven't they? But, you know, surely they are contributing to the eco crisis because a steam train requires coal.
Well, a steam train does require coal, but I can also assure you that all the steam that came out of a steam engine, the puff, 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 and billowed out of the funnel, was in fact steam and not coal fumes. You see what I mean?
No, of course, I understand that. But it requires coal to burn to create the steam.
Yeah, well, I think we should still be using coal anyway, because we can't go to net zero in 20 years and rely on the blinking wind, because the wind doesn't always blow in this country and the sun doesn't always shine. But that's another story. Miss Jones, I read a story this week, and A, I thought, that's not a story. And B, I thought, could anybody care less? And C, I thought, this newspaper that published this must be desperate to fill its pages. It was four pages on a bloke called John Bryan. And everybody will say, John who? And I almost did. But he was the guy with the bald head, the so-called American financial advisor to Fergie, the Duchess of York. And it was exclusive. 30 years on, John Bryan tells the real story about sucking Fergie's toes. I mean, I couldn't care less.
I think most people, certainly my three adult children, would have no idea, nor even care, who John Bryan ever was.
Exactly.
Second of all, he's tried to say that this was all a game, that they were playing with her children, so Beatrice and Eugenie, Prince Andrew's kids. Yeah. But I think the real story is that her marriage to Andrew was over by then anyway.
Was it?
It was over in all but name. Right. They were both playing around with different people. Okay. There were lots of rumours about Andrew at that time, and he was really putting his about all over London.
Yeah, was he?
And the thing was that this public airing, this exposure, humiliated him. And then the Queen did her usual thing once it was all out there of saying, right, well, you need to be dignified and you need to close down this marriage and divorce. Yeah. Even though she'd been dead set against divorce before, it became apparent that, this was embarrassing the royal family. Yeah. And it was always about the firm for her, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, it was, yeah. She didn't have much luck with her children's marriages, did she? Charles divorced, Anne divorced, Andrew divorced. The only one that's kept going is Edward, isn't it? I think Edward's wife became the Queen's favourite, whatever her name was. You know,
Sophie Rhys-Jones.
Sophie Rhys-Jones, that's right. Yeah,
I used to know her at Capital Radio where she worked.
Really?
And she was a bit of a girl in those days.
Really?
Oh yeah.
Oh right. Well,
I'm saying no more.
Could it be that song from the 70s? I knew the bride when she used to rock and roll.
Yeah, I think she did a little bit more than rock and roll back then.
Oh, dear me, Miss Jones, casting
a special. But it is a family show.
Yeah, it's a family show. And she presumably was a single woman in those days, yeah?
Yeah.
So, you know, she could do what she wanted. Edward's always struck me as being the dullest sort of bloke, you know what I mean? I mean, I've never seen him do anything really, you know, you could say gee whiz or gosh or anything like that. But anyway, look.
No. Do you know, the thing I remember about him was the It's a Knockout, the Royal It's a Knockout thing that they did. Do you remember? What a disaster that was.
Complete disaster. Ashley Walton was our royal correspondent in those days, okay? And he went and covered it. And I remember, and of course, we didn't have, 24-hour television in those days. I remember him ringing me and he was aghast. He said, it's the end of the royal family. I said, what do you mean? He said, this was so bad, you couldn't believe it. For the benefit of our millions of listeners, Edward had ambitions to become something in the theatre, didn't he? A thespian or something like that. So
yeah, he worked for Andrew Lloyd Webber's company, really useful.
That's right, absolutely. And he somehow convinced other sensible members of the royal family, like Princess Anne, to all dress up in sort of Tudor costume and go through a series of embarrassing and stupid games in the theme of it's a knockout, but it's a royal knockout, and thought it would be funny. And I remember at the end, Ashley told me, the facilities for the press who were reporting on it were very poor and they were kept in a little pen, you know, miles away from everything. And afterwards, they were shown into a tent to talk to Andrew. And they thought the whole thing was shocking. B, they'd been treated badly. And Andrew came in, rushed in, smiling, sat down.
Andrew or Edward?
Sorry?
Andrew or Edward?
Edward, I'm sorry, Edward. I kept saying Andrew. Edward came rushing in and still in, you know, his costume, flaked himself down on a chair, put his legs on the table and then pretended to fall asleep, opened his eyes again and said, oh, phew, that was exhausting. Did you enjoy it? And as a one, the gathered press said, no, it was awful. And he threw a tantrum, burst into tears and rushed out. Well, thanks a lot and rushed out. So that was the real story.
Burst into tears?
Yeah, Yeah, apparently, yeah, he's after all I've done, thanks a lot, and turned on his heel and rushed out, and that was it.
What a wuss. Yeah. I mean, he looks like a wuss, doesn't he, really?
Well, that's a bit harsh, you know, each man to his own type of appearance. Miss Jones, talking about exciting and not exciting, I don't suppose you've ever been into hippie crack, have you?
Oh, for goodness sake, no. No, absolutely not. But I know what it is. And I especially know what it is because it killed the son of one of our great friends on Fleet Street. Do you remember the photographer, Dave Bennett?
Yeah, I do remember Dave Bennett. Yeah, of course I do.
Yes, yes.
Dave had a swathe of black hair.
Yes, very, very sort of film star looks. Very, very suave looking.
Yes.
Lovely guy, absolutely
very nice guy. I worked with him quite a lot. He's a very nice guy. And I didn't know. And his child died.
Yeah, his wife, his name I can't remember, was Calvin McKenzie's secretary on The Sun.
Laura.
Can you remember her name?
Laura. Lorna.
No, it wasn't.
Well, there was a Lorna later. Who...
Yeah, way back in the 80s. Anyway, their son died of this stuff. It's nitrous oxide. Yeah. It's they come in these little pressurized, tiny metal canisters, and you see them all over the pavements and the roads around the place.
You do. Remember the old Soda Stream, which was the revolution?
Yeah, they look just like that.
The revolutionary machine where you put, like, orange squash into your Soda Stream, and then you put this stuff into it, carbon, whatever it is, and it turned it into orangeade, you know what I mean? It turned ordinary water into tonic water and all that kind of stuff. I mean, everybody had one in the 70s and they all ended up on a tip somewhere in Thailand. But no, the point is, you're absolutely right. They're just like that. Apparently, they're incredibly dangerous. They give you a huge high for about 15 seconds and they're very addictive and you want to take another one. But the reason I mentioned it is apparently They've done away now with the little valves that you're talking about. They're in huge canisters, you know, the size of a spray for furniture or something like that, and they spray it up the nose. I mean, sounds ghastly.
It's become popular again because, it's been around since the 1700s, actually.
Really?
They were using it back then as a painkiller. Doctors and dentists were using it, and also for childbirth.
Yeah.
And so on. But since the festival phenomenon has erupted, a lot of festival goers have been using it. We used to call it laughing gas.
Laughing gas, yeah, that's right, yeah. How could it have been around in the 1700s? How did they contain gas in containers in those days?
Yeah, well, I think it wasn't obviously contained in metal little canisters or whatever, but it must have been contained in some other kind of thing. But but it was developed certainly. In the first recorded use of it is in 1772.
Good God, amazing. Miss Jones, you are a mine of information, I have to say. Right, okay, folks, that's it for another week. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Life on Planet Porky, and we'll be back with you all again this time next week. Sven was a mega shagger. I mean, apparently from day one, you know, Sven was prowling the corridors of the Football Association headquarters in, I think it was in Soho Square then, you know, looking at all the available sort of potential conquests he could make with the women there. And he did make a lot. And it caused a lot of scandals. And at one time, the chief executive actually quit because it was discovered that Sven and a chief executive were seeing the same lady. I mean, it was unbelievable, honestly. And
I never saw what any of these women saw in him. Well, had he not been the England manager, I mean, just take the elements of that individual, that person.
Yeah.
There's nothing really to kind of drop your jaws for, is there?
Well, Miss Jones, this is a family show, and I don't think expressions like drop your jaws, you know, is necessarily...
Well, how is that more offensive than mega shagger?
Well, yes, okay, I take your point. Would you go and buy a 5'7" teddy bear called Loving Bear Puffy, and could you ever imagine that being a substitute for a real live human being companion?
Oh, don't be ridiculous. This is a horrible idea, isn't it? It's akin to having a blow-up doll.
Miss Jones, talking about exciting and not exciting, I don't suppose you've ever been into hippie crack, have you?
Oh, for goodness sake, no.